Hannes Meyer never stops being a protagonist for this group of people. But eventually Meyer is left behind. And people like Tolziner, Konrad Puschel, or René Mensch, and Weiner in particular, will continue to be connected to what they learned in the Bauhaus, but also have careers of their own. My name is Daniel Talisnik. I studied architecture in the Universidad Católica de Chile, and then I went for a master's and a PhD to Columbia University in New York.
My name is Anja Guttenberger, and this is my podcast, Bauhaus Faces. Welcome back to a new episode of Bauhaus Faces. Thanks for tuning in again. A brand new episode of Bauhaus Faces is finally here. This time I talk to the Chilean architect and architecture historian Daniel Talisnik about a whole group of Bauhaus students while taking a closer look at the life of one of them, the architect Thibaut Weiner. Weiner was part of a group that formed around the second Bauhaus director and Swiss architect Hannes Meyer, the so-called Red Bauhaus Brigade. If you are a regular listener of Bauhaus Faces, you will have already binged the three episodes about Hannes Meyer and the episode about his wife, Lina Meyer-Bergner, too, I guess. If so, you already know that Meyer was dismissed from the Bauhaus in 1930 and that he subsequently went to the Soviet Union. Lina Bergner soon followed. Seven of Meyer's former architecture students from the Bauhaus wanted to continue working with Meyer as their mentor and also followed him to Moscow. And those students were Bela Scheffler, Antonin Urban, Konrad Püschel, René Mensch, Klaus Neumann, Philipp Tolziner and Thibaut Weiner, an international crowd that had befriended during their studies at the Bauhaus in Dessau and their work of the Dessau Turton houses with balcony access and the HGB Trade Union School. Daniel Talisnik, who is currently a lecturer in architecture history at the University of Bath in the UK, dedicated his PhD thesis with the title The Itinerant Red Bauhaus or the Third Immigration to this group, and Thibaut Weiner in particular, following their adventurous trails after the group had fallen apart. In Thibaut Weiner's case, it was a trail that took him from the Soviet Union to a stopover in Paris, then on to the other end of the world in Chile, and after the Second World War, back to his homeland, Hungary. Architecture, for Weiner as for many of his fellow Red Bauhaus Brigade comrades, was the tool to survive. As a Jew and communist, Weiner faced constant dangers in a world when both were persecuted in different parts of the world. He was lucky because architects were needed in one place or another, although at that point, under the pressure to design in line with the regime, he seems to have been unable to build what he believed was great architecture. During our conversation, Daniel also told me a lot about some of the other members of the Red Bauhaus Brigade, each of whom had lived through their own unique life stories. We therefore decided to meet again to record a bonus episode for you about Konrad Püschel, whose job in the GDR took him as far as North Korea, Ernst Mensch, who ended up in Iran, and Philipp Tolziner, who after his 10-year imprisonment in a gulag in the Soviet Union, became one of the first monument preservationists of the Soviet Union. So, don't forget to look out for this episode later this month too. And please don't forget to give Bauhaus Faces a 5-star review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts and to recommend it to friends, family and colleagues who might be interested in the lives and work of Bauhauslers too. Now, without much further ado, let's dive into a new episode of Bauhaus Faces and shine a light on Thibaut Weiner and the Red Bauhaus Brigade.
Thibaut Weiner is precisely my way in to the larger research because he lived in Chile for a period of time, almost parallel to the Second World War, from 39 to 48. And I was very curious about what he did there. And that led to basically reconstructing, we could say, the universe from where he had emerged as an architect, an educator. I've met in person two of his three daughters, and I've been able to reconstruct a little bit the story of his childhood and the background of the family. Tibor Vajner was born in 1906 in Budapest, in Hungary. He came from a Jewish household, and his father worked in some capacity for the kingdom. He worked in the mills, apparently. So they were an upper middle class family. Why did he study architecture? That's a question that I can't answer, but I know that he studied architecture between 1924 and 1928. And he studied in a university that was called the Franz Josef Royal University, which is today the Technical University of Budapest. And it was a university, at least in the career of architecture, that was based or modeled a little bit after the Zurich ETH. So architects with a technical emphasis, architect engineers. The only difference is that there was an emphasis on architectural history, which I am not sure if that was the case in the ETH at the time. The Bauhaus, there was a very active connection with Hungarians. That's one thing that could be said, including Marcel Breuer had been born in Hungary, Laszlo Moholy-Nagy was Hungarian, but most importantly, or more specifically, an architect called Farkas Molnár had been to the Bauhaus, and after Vajner studied architecture, he worked for Farkas Molnár in Budapest. So that's my speculation, that that encounter led him to know about the Bauhaus. It should be established that when Farkas Molnár was in the Bauhaus until 1935, there wasn't really an architectural program, you could say. So this was a new thing, the formal architectural training in the Bauhaus that had started to happen in 1927 with the arrival of Hannes Meyer. Architects or people that studied in the Bauhaus before there was a formal architectural program, they did, quote unquote, maybe not train as architects, but they could work in architectural related things under the supervision of Walter Gropius. So there are architectural projects in the period. Probably the most emblematic of those projects is the Haus am Horn in Weimar, but it's not the only one. There were Siedlungs and other things designed at the period, and it is understood that they were directly supervised by the architects and the faculty, even working from their private offices. But there was no formal architectural training until Hannes Meyer arrived. Yeah, he worked for Parligeti and Farkas Molnár from March to October 1929, according to one of his CVs. And he will go or enroll in the Bauhaus in Dessau in the winter of 1929. His enrollment number was 391. Well, everybody, including the postgraduate students, had to go through the four course, which at that moment in time was taught by Josef Albers and roughly be translated as material and handicrafts. And then he also took a class with Vasily Kandinsky. He took a class of figure drawing with Jost Schmidt. He took a class of representational drawing with Fritz Kur. We know that also he audited several classes for which he probably wasn't evaluated with a grade, like business studies and psychotechnics with Hans Riedel, or he attended lectures also by architect Paul Artaria. Some other basic courses we know for a fact from one of his CVs, like mathematics, chemistry, descriptive geometry, he was exempted from because he had already done similar courses in his undergraduate studies. It's interesting because I think that if you were a postgraduate study, you were allowed to do a semester of the four course only. That's what I remember from my understanding, not a full year of the four course. So the second semester, he worked directly with Hannes Meyer. At least that's what's established in his CV. He became his assistant. I know for a fact, because there's a recommendation letter from Hannes Meyer to Tibor Vajner that I study as part of the documents that I reviewed for my thesis. He says precisely that from May 1st, 1930 until October 15th, 1930, following my petition, meaning that he asked Vajner, Vajner worked in my private practice in Berlin, preparing plans for the publication of the ADGB trade union school in Bernau near Berlin and drawing the municipal building inspection plans for this project. He did a project with Philipp Torziner in 1930 called Community Dwelling for the Workers of a Factory in a Socialized State that they didn't do as part of a class assignment. They did it, let's say, out of free will, or it was a freelance student project because they wanted to get feedback from the teachers. So definitely Philipp Torziner must have been a close friend. And those were studies that they conducted in the room of Philipp Torziner in his apartment in Dessau. This is one of the projects that I found published in several books when I started doing my research, and that gave me a clue early on that Weiner had existed and that he had been in the Bauhaus. It was one of the earliest, let's say, proofs of that. It's kind of a block that has living quarters for workers. It's for a nondescript or non-specified city, but it's a study of, let's say, minimum dwelling for workers. And particularly political in its outlook, no? From the title forward.
For those of you who have already listened to my podcast episode on Bauhaus Faces about Ludwig Hilbersheimer, you may wonder, just as I did, if this freelance project by Tibor Weiner and Philipp Tolzina at the Bauhaus was maybe influenced by him. Hilbersheimer too intensively engaged in social housing and the existential minimum, offering different solutions from low-rise and mid-rise buildings to high-rise apartment hotels with shared communal spaces, sometimes even mixing all three housing types in one urban plan. Hilbersheimer became head of the building department in 1929 at the Bauhaus when Hans Witwe had left the Bauhaus. He carried on with certain scientific approaches that Witwe had introduced, like the study of the sunlight and the ways the inhabitants of a new building would take, and then further developed those studies by looking at the natural ventilation and so forth. This is exactly what Tibor Weiner and his fellow students of the building department did in their freelance studies. And there are even multiple other examples of this. But I won't get into that right now. Anyway, I asked Daniel Telesnik if he knew about a connection between Hilbersheimer and Weiner, and this is what he answered.
It's not that he didn't encounter Ludwig Hilbersheimer at the Bauhaus. He didn't take classes with him. But for instance, Konrad Püschel, who was one of the original members of the Red Bauhaus Brigade, he did in 1928, before Weiner was there. In any case, the social preoccupation and how people live was something that then Hilbersheimer, when he lived in Chicago, was very connected to. That same exercise that we've been commenting, that is roughly translated as community dwelling for the workers of a factory in a socialized state, when they pinned this exercise in the Bauhaus, the person that was most impressed, according to a memoir from Philipp Tolzina, was Ludwig Hilbersheimer with this project. And he suggested to them that it should be published under a different title, one without the socialist reference. However, they rejected this idea, Tolzina and Weiner. This is part of a memoir or memory from Philipp Tolzina. Did Hilbersheimer actually say that? It's impossible to prove. But that's in a text by him called Mit Hannes Meyer am Bauhaus und in der Sowjetunion. We know for a fact that he was expelled from the Bauhaus on September 9th, 1930, along with a lot of the foreigners that had been studying there at the time and that were involved in some capacity in political activities and that left, well, were invited to leave after the dismissal of Hannes Meyer. In those images of the expelled group of foreign students leaving Dessau, and I've identified Bella Scheffler, Antonin Urban, Tibor Weiner, Munio Weinraub, and Ladislaus Fußmann in the photographs. And the classmates go and bid them farewell.
Well, being expelled not just from a school, but also from a whole town, in this case the Bauhaus in Dessau, I thought must have had fundamental reasons. In Weiner's case, and in the case of the other Bauhaus students that were expelled from the Bauhaus, the reasons were never clearly addressed by any of them. At least so far, no researcher has found any document about that. So I asked Daniel if this might have had to do with their involvement with the Communist Party or the Kostufra, a communist student group at the Bauhaus. I'll jump ahead to what Daniel replied, namely that, according to his research, only one of the expelled students was a member of the Kostufra. I then asked, what did he think the reasons were? Let's listen to Daniel, who elaborates on my questions and uncovers the chronology of events that might have led to the expulsion.
I'm not 100% sure if Tibor Weiner was a member of the Kostufra. You ask me that. In my research, he doesn't appear like one. Based on Fodor's recollections and other documents, I know that, for instance, Hans Aldner, Willy Jung-Mittag, Waldemar Adler, Ernst Mittag, Etelvolor, Ricarda Meltzer, Heinz Schwerin, Ladislau Fußmann, Bella Scheffler, and Martin Decker, also another student called Albert Buske, were official members of the Costufra. But others like Antonin Urban, Klaus Moimann, Konrad Puschel, Philipp Tolziner, and Weiner, I understand they sympathized with the left, of course, but they were not members of the Costufra. Tolziner, in his memoir, he makes clear that neither him nor Weiner were active in politics in the Bauhaus, although they were clearly interested in left-wing ideas. But they were not student representatives of the Communist Party or something along those lines. So that has been clarified by Tolziner in his memoir. Soon after the expulsion of Hannes Meyer from the Bauhaus, there is a letter that I found among the documents signed by Antonin Urban, Tibor Weiner, and Bella Scheffler in August 4 of 1930, which is only 3 days after Hannes Meyer is expelled from the Bauhaus. Probably more people signed afterwards. It's in official stationery from Bella Scheffler, who must have had some sort of architectural operation because it says Bella Scheffler Architect on the top. And there's a paragraph that reads, "We are thinking that it would be right if we could stay together with you. We should discuss in what capacity. For now, we just want to tell you that this is what we want." So it's a sign-up sheet or a letter in support of Hannes Meyer. It's understood that they sent to him. So that's the origin or a first piece of evidence of the fact that they wanted to stay together as a group and to work with Meyer as a mentor, right? And I interpret in my research that basically their move to the Soviet Union as a group is a continuation of their education. We do know that when Mies is named the director at the start of the next semester, he makes all of the students sign a document establishing that they will not be active in politics. It could coincide with the fact that some students didn't sign or agreed or something along those lines, although the Costufra still works underground during his time, and that we're not expelled. And that's when he closes the Preller house and asks the students to find another accommodation and a series of other measures to prevent political association. He converts the Preller house from studios to workrooms, and there's guest room for teachers in the fifth floor. So Meyer is expelled August 1st, 1930. The students write that support letter on the 4th of August, saying that they want to stay together. Then by August 5th, Mies signs a contract, and by September 9th, some of the foreigners are expelled. He gives him an official diploma. Mies van der Rohe signs Tibor Weiner's diploma in December 1930.
To put it quite clearly, the document that Daniel Telesnik has found here, the sign-up sheet in support of Hannes Meyer as a mentor, could well mark the official birth of the Red Bauhaus Brigade, a group of Bauhaus students who gathered around Hannes Meyer and eventually emigrated with him to the Soviet Union. The chronology of events that Daniel outlined shows that this written declaration of support for Hannes Meyer, made immediately after the dismissal as Bauhaus director, would have been a perfectly valid reason to expel the students from the school as well. On the other hand, it is possible that they did not sign the document demanded by Mies van der Rohe, in which they were required to pledge that they would not engage in political activity. Mies van der Rohe, as the third and final Bauhaus director, was, like his predecessors Walter Gropius and Hannes Meyer, under intense political pressure, particularly in the early 1930s as the NSDAP, the National Socialist Party in Germany, gained increasing support, and the Bauhaus had by then been branded a red stronghold, even though this had little to do with reality because it was only part of the Bauhaus. It is questionable whether a mere refusal to sign would have led to an immediate expulsion from the city altogether. The students' loyalty to Hannes Meyer, however, who had been dismissed from the Bauhaus in absence on the grounds of alleged political activities, would have been a perfectly logical reason. It seems that Mies wouldn't have had any other option than expelling the students. Tibor Weiner's Bauhaus diploma, signed by Mies van der Rohe in late 1930, seems to suggest that he was on the side of the expelled students, and that their expulsion from the school was not entirely and voluntarily decided by the Bauhaus director alone. If you are interested in this particular time, I recommend listening to the podcast episodes of Bauhaus Faces about Hannes Meyer and Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, in which I discussed this period with the art historians Dara Kiese, Tatjana Efrusi, Fritz Neumeier, and Vita Nowak too. Let's go now back to Daniel and see what Tibor Weiner and his fellow Red Bauhaus Brigade comrades did after they were expelled from the Bauhaus and from Dessau.
He stayed in Germany, and he's part of the group that was enthused by the idea of joining Hannes Meyer in the Soviet Union. Because after Meyer was expelled, let's say this to narrate the story, he presented himself in the Soviet consulate in Berlin and offered his services. So he coordinated an invitation for himself, if you will, with the support of several people. And that took a while, because he first leaves with one of the students called Bela Scheffler, who was from Belarus, but of Hungarian extraction, if you will. And he goes in October 1930 to the Soviet Union. But the other six students, among which we find Weiner, and their names are Klaus Moimann, Antonin Urban, Konrad Püschel, Philipp Tolziner, René Mensch, and Tibor Weiner, they won't arrive until early 1931. They are a very international group. I started by saying that Bela Scheffler was from Belarus, Klaus Moimann, German, Antonin Urban was Czech, Konrad Püschel was German, Philipp Tolziner, German as well, but René Mensch was Swiss. So it's a very representative group of what was the reality at the Bauhaus at that point in time, a very international studentship. It was very difficult to bring them to the Soviet Union. Well, they got visas or papers and received official invitations and they could travel. But at some point, when Hannes Meyer is already in the Soviet Union and they are still waiting for their papers, and I believe they're leaving together, some of them, waiting for the papers to arrive, there's a discussion of how are they going to be paid or how much they're going to be paid. And Hannes Meyer explains to them that it looks like not enough money, but actually you can live quite well on that sum. It's a non-consumerist society, and he goes into that line of explanations. Because a lot of what happens to Hannes Meyer in the Soviet Union, and probably talked about this in detail with Tatjana Efrusi, is that he becomes a communist. He gets indoctrinated formally, if you will. He starts studying Marxism, and the letters that he sends to Lotte Beze at that point in time, eventually Lotte Stambeze was his partner at the time of those letters. He says to her things like, you need to study more before coming here, you wouldn't make a good socialist. Anyway, there's a lot of discussion of him being, let's say, a new version of himself, because he has encountered a society that works under different premises and that is going native. So Tolziner, Urban, and Weiner did one of the entries for the 1931 competition for the Palace of the Soviets. This was one of the stages of a competition that had several. And they claimed that Hannes Meyer was a consultant. And Hannes Meyer reinforces this idea. But how true is this? Meaning, probably he was more involved than just as a consultant. What is important about this competition, it's clearly a modern project, although it has some hints of what would be socialist realism later. And we can deal with that immediately. Those hints are a compound of statues that were located in the square, four statues that were called something along the lines of the five-year plan in 4 years. And then there's also a frieze in the main building that had a motto. And you could say that that's also something that would appear in the architecture towards the end of the 1930s in the Soviet Union. But it is a modern project, and it's two buildings. There's an administrative center that had a seating capacity of 5,900 people. And then the big building, the Congress Hall, had a seating capacity for 15,000. It's parallel to the river, and there's a very big square between the two buildings. It's a rectangular lot. In the middle of the compound, and this is perhaps what's most interesting about the project, there is a large public space that was 220 by 110 meters. And this, we can call it a civic plaza, could be activated in different formats depending on what was happening. You could have bleachers, you could have a stage, or certain other configurations. And what's most striking about this project is that for the May 1st demonstrations and also for the anniversary of the revolution, meaning when there's marching crowds, the crowds could go under the small building and literally enter the bigger building and march through it. Very interesting project that they participated as a subgroup of the Red Bauhaus Brigade during the period that they were still together working as a group in one of the trusts in Moscow. They lived together with Hannes Meyer in Abad Square, and there's some photographs of that in the documents of Tolziner. You can find the floor plan. It's a big apartment and the distribution of how they organize the apartment. There's a room for Weiner, one for Urban, one for Puschel, one for Moimann, one for René Mensch. There's one for Bella Scheffler, one for Hannes Meyer. There's one shared bathroom with a shower. There's probably a smaller bathroom without a shower. And there's other two people that live in the house as well that are not part of the so-called Red Bauhaus Brigade. Yeah, they're invited to work in a trust that's called Giproftus, which is the construction of higher and technical educational colleges trust. And they are there as a group between 1931 and 1933. Hannes Meyer is involved in the beginning, but soon after he leaves this trust to assume other responsibilities, but this group of students stays there. And they're designing schools, prototypes, and so on. They work for places like Tashkent, Baku, and that lasts until 33. What happened to the Red Bauhaus Brigade members after 1933, when they stopped working together as a group in Giproftus? What's most interesting, for me at least, is that unlike Meyer, many of the members of the brigade were able to build in the Soviet Union, meaning that the designs that they did got built. Urban, for instance, allegedly designed and built a vocational school in Novokuznetsk. In 1932 also, Bela Scheffler went to work for an architect called Peter Oranskij, and he worked in the planning of a new city called Uralmash. And he designed a series of buildings, among them a school with 10 classrooms and also a stadium. Most importantly, at least for the group that I study more in detail, in 1933, Puschel, Tolziner, and Weiner joined former Ernst May Brigade members Marc Stamm and Hans Schmidt in designing the city of Orsk, where they would remain until 1936. As was normally the case for new towns, Orsk was built to accompany an industrial operation on the banks of a river, in this case the Ural River. This is towards the border with Kazakhstan. Eventually, Schmidt had sole charge of the design of this project, modifying the center-less first proposal and rearranging the buildings on the short sides of the rectangular city blocks by rotating them 90 degrees to create basically a profile of a main street. Under Schmidt, the three former Bauhaus Brigade members took on design and construction tasks, individually or in pairs. They took charge of whole city sectors. Moreover, since qualified laborers were very scarce, they also had the duty or the responsibility of training workers with no building experience, which was also part of their job there. The project that they did with Tolziner was, you could say, a prototype for housing workers. And I've associated it more in my mind with the ADGB trade union school and the way that workers were housed there in brigades, although they slept together in rooms, but that type of minimal living. The kwartals in Orsk were for workers and their families, so there were different type of housings. I don't know the details of the project of the socialized state that we've talked about. I've seen the plans and I can derive conclusions from that. But what I can tell you from the buildings in Orsk is, yeah, they're blocks of building. They look pretty much like a housing neighborhood in any socialist city during the post-war. Generally speaking, we can say that the first show trials in the Soviet Union started in 1936, and this prompted the beginning of the exodus of all foreigners who could leave. Even those who remained an extra year, like it was the case of Tibor Weiner, left the Soviet Union by November 1937 at the latest, if they were able to do so. We commented, for instance, that Philipp Tolziner, being of Jewish extraction, by 1937, with the Nuremberg racial laws already having been promoted in Germany, he had no passport. He was no longer a German citizen, so he could not return to Germany. Those who ended up staying usually had no choice, but their destinies were very tragic. They ended up either murdered or they were sent to the Gulag. under accusations, usually of espionage. Hannes Meyer, for instance, left the Soviet Union in 1936. No matter how much Meyer and the other Red Bauhaus Brigade members had identified with the Soviet project, we can say that it was clear to them, first and foremost, that they could not live at that point in time at the service of it. So he leaves November 1937, very last minute, after he worked with Hans Schmidt and Marge Stamm in Orsk. He works in other trusts and does other projects here and there. But we find him towards the last stage, administrating some designs that had been left behind by Margarete Schutlihovsky. So he's kind of the person that stays in charge of them. She has left already with Schutte. Probably a combination of the political situation and the lack of work. And also the turning currents in the design. Yeah, it was the beginning also of socialist realism being imposed and so on. What we can't say is that he left because he could. And there's a brief stint in Austria, which is very strange, and I have never been able to confirm why he goes to Vienna, but eventually he spends a whole year in Paris. In connection also again with Margarete Schutlihovsky, they will design or make a competition for a school with a local architect called Pierre Forestier that doesn't get built in the outskirts of Paris. And then the year that he spends in Paris, he's desperate to leave. He's just looking for a way out. We have evidence of all the letters that he writes. He's trying to get a job in Australia. He's trying to find, just literally trying to leave Europe.
Thibaut Weiner's efforts to leave are best documented in a series of letters that he exchanged with his mentor, Hannes Meyer, starting in 1937, when Weiner writes to Meyer, "I really want to get to the other end of the world as soon as possible, if not to the moon." The correspondence is today part of the Hannes Meyer estate at the Deutsche Architekturmuseum in Frankfurt am Main, at the Damm.
They will write to each other very actively in that period that he's in France, and then they will write to each other also when one is in Mexico and the other is in Chile. Less frequent, but still there is some communication between them. So there's several letters from 1938, 1939, when he's trying to literally find a way out. The letters from Paris is asking for advice on what to do, where should he go, or telling him what he's planning to do, exchanging information and informing each other of what's happened to who after they last saw each other. And interestingly, he tells them that there could be prospects in the United States. He tells them specifically that he has evaluated South Africa, England and Ceylon. He says that Hans Schmidt, who he had worked for in Orsk, had spoken to him about opportunities in what is now Sri Lanka, right? He has also considered Chile in one of the early letters, Argentina and Mexico, as possible immigration destinations. We do know for a fact that in 1938, Weiner attempted to obtain immigration papers to Australia via the Australian Jewish Welfare Society. And he also wrote to the Australian Department of Interior in Canberra, but nothing came of it. And also at some point he tries to get papers to go to Ankara in Turkey, but nothing happens. The exact reason of why Chile, I do not know. Certain things make sense or connect to each other quite logically. I have the speculation of this very big earthquake, and there was the need for architects. Impossible to confirm until now, but that's my assumption. There's competing information in the papers. The people that sign is Visa. I can't quite figure out why. They're involved in the quote-unquote operation of him moving to Chile, but clearly there is someone that supports or sponsors his visa application that is connected to the architect for whom he will work when he arrives in Chile. And eventually he does work in the reconstruction efforts. And there is a fire station in a city called Chillán that is built, that he designed, that has to do with this earthquake reconstruction. There is a competition in a city called Concepción for a market that never gets built, not the project that he designed. It gets built, but designed by other architects. So it does happen that he's involved in this reconstruction in some capacity. So that's how we speculate about that. He gets married right before to a fellow Hungarian, and he arrives in Chile towards the end of 1939. An interesting project, perhaps because it was the biggest one that he won, was this municipal market for the city of Concepción, won in 1940. And it was going to be located one street away from the city's central square. And it was a whole city block. And actually, there is a market now in ruins because it got burned. And there are some projects to reconstruct it or retrofit it in some way or another. But it is a complex project. You could say there was a central nucleus, an octagon, literally, and or two-story wings that spanned from this octagon. And each of these wings was going to be devoted to different activities within the market. One for milk and animal produce, one for fish and seafood, another one for meat-related products, and then a fourth one for wholesale products. And the central space was reserved for fruits and vegetables, the octagon proper. It's a very functionalist building in the sense that everything works very sectorized, and you could say that it is connected to his 1932 type project for a pedagogical institute of technology that he did under another trust that was called the Vustoy Project in Moscow. Because this project featured three wings with a semicircular auditorium set before a Y-shaped scheme. So the fact of having a central body and then having different volumes or pavilions emerging from it is comparable. But then again, that's very functionalist in general. It's not particular to what he designed. It's part of something that was happening at the time. He was connected to a group of students that were leading at that point in time in 1946, the reform of the oldest architectural school in the country, of the University of Chile. So it was a student-led reform in which they were trying to reorganize the curriculum. And they were connected by a structural engineer, a fellow Hungarian, that knew Tibor Weiner and knew one of the students. And he said, well, I know somebody who has a lot of experience in education and maybe he could give you a hand. And the rest is history, because he really assessed them in building up a very organized study program that took a lot from the last version of Hannes Meyer's Bauhaus study program, the one that was not implemented. But a lot of the courses that he had taken as a student at the Bauhaus, you can see them being replicated in the Chilean curriculum. If we look at the chart of subjects of the Chilean program, it was divided into two cycles. The first cycle went from first year to the middle of third year. It was called the Anánesis cycle. And the second cycle went from the middle of third year until the end of the sixth year. It was called the Synthesis cycle. After these two cycles of education were finished, students would move on to do a final degree project. So it's a very long study period, right? Becoming an architect would take 7 to 7.5 years under this scheme. The two cycles, regardless whether it was the analysis or the synthesis cycle, they were also suborganized under blocks. And there was a philosophical block, a sociological block, a plastic block, and a technical block. So students, for example, in first year would study architectural analysis, which was the core class of the first year. And then under the sociological block, they would have a class called biology and hygiene, very similar to things that were being instructed at the Bauhaus at the time and related to this idea of how biology and architecture are intrinsically connected and the body in space needs to be understood from certain life premises, if you will. In the plastic block, they had classes that were called composition, plastics, technical drawing. And in the technical block, they had more technical courses, literally speaking, mathematics, descriptive geometry, technical physics, and technology of materials. And the program advanced, and it's very detailed. Second year in the sociological block, they had social economy, for instance. So it built up in that way. And I've seen how this overlaps with that last scheme of a study program of Hannes Meyer's Bauhaus, and clearly it's literal. Even the name of the courses are the same. Not all of them, but many of them. It's based on, that would be probably a precise way of describing it. Through Weiner, the architectural scene in Chile, not only in the University of Chile, because this got broadcasted and it ended up influencing how architecture was taught in the other school, in a way, and also it had an effect on the region. Some of the courses had an effect on how architecture began to be taught in Peru, so on and so forth. So I would say that through Weiner, the architectural scene in Chile was enriched by the transmission of aspects, the emphasis is on aspects, from a stage of the Bauhaus's culture. But what's interesting is that this is not only in terms of content, that is one thing, but also in terms of social, cultural, and political agendas. The emphasis on the social, because you have to understand that these students were trying to transition from a more Beaux-Arts way of being taught architecture that had more to do with, you could say, in very general terms, architecture as an art form, and transition to something that was closer to the real needs of a country like Chile by 1946. The need for housing for workers, the need for more hospitals, you know, public infrastructures of those natures. So that's the background for their desire to reform the study program. Education that is more connected to the real needs of society at that point in time.
To properly understand Tibor Weiner's situation in Chile, I asked Daniel Talesnik to briefly share some background on the political atmosphere there at the time.
He arrived during one of the three governments from the Radical Party, which is center-left. They're all slightly different in nature, but there is an emphasis on education. So he arrives during the first of these governments of the Partido Radical, a president that was called Pedro Aguirre Cerda, who ruled between 1938 and 1941. He will be there throughout the presidency of the second of this radical as in the name of the party, not radical as in their attitude. Presidents called Juan Antonio Ríos, who ruled between 1942 and 1946, and he will leave at the start, more or less, of the third of these presidencies from the same party, president called Gabriel González Videla. And he will turn things around because he wins with the support of the Communist Party, but then he turns against them and bans the Communist Party. And the wife of Tibor Weiner, Judith Vadja, was a journalist that worked for the Communist newspaper. And he was in the mix also in some capacity or another through friendships, through acquaintances. His social circle was all people connected to this. So they decided to leave. The party was proscribed a little bit afterwards they left, if I remember the chronology correctly, but it was already in the air that things were going to get complicated for people with communist allegiances. He doesn't leave Chile in a good predicament. So based on the letters, I don't know how that played out towards the later stage of his life, but based on the letters that he's writing, as he's leaving Chile, he leaves embittered, and not only because of the political situation, he had run also into complicated economical situation. He's left with some debts or unpaid work from an architect that he was partnered with in the first stage, and then he works for real estate speculators, let's say designing buildings for constructors or so on. So he finds it very hard to make a living towards the last stage of his life in Chile. By then, they had two daughters. There's a third daughter that will be born in Hungary when they return. And you have to think that he's a person that has been on the run a couple of times already and has encountered this type of situations. He leaves the Soviet Union in the nick of time before foreigners and his close friends run into extremely complicated types of troubles. Several of them die in that period. Then he will leave France also in the 23rd hour, very last minute. Probably some of the last ships that can sail before the break of the war. And third time that he's under the same type of political pressure.
In 1948, Tibor Weiner left Chile with his wife and two daughters to return to his homeland, Hungary. In a letter to Pierre Forestier, with whom he had worked in Paris in the late 1930s alongside Margarita Schütte-Lihotzky, he wrote, "My time in Chile seems like a nightmare to me, and I'm glad to be on my way to Hungary." In Hungary, a new chapter of his life began, opening up new professional prospects.
As I've been told by the daughters, his parents died during the Second World War, but his mother-in-law was still alive in Hungary, so they decide to reconnect with his wife's mother. The moment he arrives, he becomes a member of the Communist Party. And a lot of what will happen to him afterwards as a professional architect will have to do with that. Eventually, he wins the head of a team that wins the master plan for a city that was originally called Stalinváros, which is now called Donauváros, which is connected to a steelworks in Hungary, which is completely crazy also because all of the natural resources that are needed to produce steel are not there. Everything travels by boat. That's why it's by the Donau. And they win this competition at some point. And the city's renamed Donauvaros in 1961. And it's 70 kilometers from Budapest. And it's the most important project of the post-war five-year plans of Hungary. Hungary's first five-year plan runs from 1950 to 54, if you count 1950's 5 years. But he does this urban planning, and that competition begins being executed in 1950. So it's to house the workers for the steelworks. According to people that study him in more detail for his Hungarian last stage, he couldn't design necessarily what he wanted to or didn't have the type of opportunities that he wanted to. But eventually this master plan is a very big deal, although he does build the headquarters of the Communist Party in the main square of the town. And it's a socialist, realist building that, according to his daughters, he was not proud of. That won him some sort of very important prize also. But he had a very fruitful life as an educator again. Through documents that I found, he was very important in some sort of postgraduate program, and he developed ideas for prefabricated architecture. Someone in Hungary has done in-depth analysis of that, and as I edit my manuscript, I'm quoting the research of a colleague in Hungary. And he becomes involved in the city administration of the city of Donauvaros also. Become some sort of city architect. Architecture is what allowed him to survive because it's nonverbal language, you could say. You can work as an architect in different circumstances without necessarily being from the place. The fact that they could go to the Soviet Union and start working on drawings and designing things, and that then he shows up in a place like Chile and he can do the same and collaborate. And it's understood that at the beginning, he didn't speak a word of Spanish. So that's another dimension of their story. It's kind of what moved them around. In this case, in particular, some sort of force of disillusionment, but also what, in some capacity, allowed him to survive.
This would have been a perfect end for this podcast episode about Tibor Weiner in and of itself, don't you think? But in the end, Daniel again stressed how important Hannes Meyer was for this group, the Red Bauhaus Brigade, and that there had been others too. So we talked a little more about Daniel's research and the striking findings regarding other members of the brigade, Bauhaus students who, like Tibor Weiner, had followed Meyer to the Soviet Union and then went their separate ways, pursuing their own careers, sometimes in the most remote corners of the world.
Hannes Meyer never stops being a protagonist for this group of people. And it's impossible to tell their story without emphasizing Meyer. But eventually Meyer is left behind and they have their own careers. And people like Tolziner, Konrad Puschel, or René Mensch, and Weiner in particular, will continue to be connected to what they learned in the Bauhaus, but also have careers of their own doing things that are less connected to where they studied. The Jew is Tolziner. He's the one that tries to reconstruct the story of the brigade. So in his archive, you find his efforts to reconnect with all of them. And he's the one that has news from the rest. But it's an archive that's full of duplicates or triplicates, we should say. In my research, I make the distinction between what I'm calling the third migration, which are architects, not only from the Bauhaus, but a lot of them from the Bauhaus that at some point go to the Soviet Union and eventually get displaced to the most faraway places in the map of the world. And then there's a tendency that they reconvene in Europe after the war. So they have different stages and many of them are associated to, if not the Communist Party, to left-wing ideas. And that has a lot to do also to why they move and why they travel. You should add in cases like Weiner, the fact that he was Jewish extraction, and there was that in the mix in his desire to leave Europe in 1939, of course. But I make the point that they're very different from the Bauhaus that ends up in the United States. Gropius in Harvard and Mies in IIT, there's a whole very official legacy to their stories. These stories are way more scattered. There's way more gluing to do.
Today, the traces of Bauhaus architect Tibor Weiner are scattered, held partly in the archive of the Architecture Museum in Budapest, the Moi Moje Epitechet, and partly preserved by his daughters. Through his estate and through the remarkably concise estate that Philipp Tolzina left to the Bauhaus archive in Berlin, Daniel Talesnik was able to piece together Weiner's life. What he and a wider circle of art and architectural historians have uncovered is nothing short of extraordinary. The story of those Bauhauslers who sought to continue the ideals of new building in the Soviet Union when building as a modern architect was about to come to a halt in Germany. In places like Orsk, they scaled up their ambitions dramatically, designing vast housing complexes for 1,000 to 3,000 people, a far cry from the more intimate experiments of the Dessau-Turten houses with balcony access that they had planned and built at the Bauhaus. But as history turned under Stalin's tightening grip, not all of them made it through. The years of the so-called Great Purge, set off by the start of the Moscow show trials of 1936, claimed many lives. Yet a few managed to escape in time, carrying their ideas across borders and forging new paths as architects in a world that had irrevocably changed. I will link two essential publications in the show notes that deepen this story even further. First, Tatiana Ifrusi's recent book, Hannes Meyer, Soviet Architect, Life and Work in the USSR, 1930 to 1936. Longtime listeners might recognize Tatiana from part two of my episode on Hannes Meyer. And if you haven't heard it yet, it's well worth a revisit on Bauhaus Faces. In her work, she brings to life the realities of communal living of the Red Bauhaus Brigade at Arbeit Square, the shifting political climate of the Soviet Union, and the looming shadow of the show trials. Secondly, I want to highlight the extensive and deeply committed research of Astrid Volpert. In many ways, her work laid the ground for scholars like Tatiana Ifrusi and Daniel Talesnik. Volpert was among the first art historians to travel to Russia after the end of the Soviet Union in 1991, digging not only into German archives, but Russian ones as well, as far as possible. In a 2019 article for the Bauhaus Imaginista online journal, she had already traced the path of 62 former Bauhauslers, students, teachers, and administrative staff, including figures like the Bauhaus secretary Margarete Mengel, who had all made their way to the Soviet Union. Painters, graphic designers, architects, photographers, weavers, an international constellation spanning 11 nations, 15 women, 47 men. 21 were members of the Communist Party, and 18 went to obtain citizenship in their host country. I would like to thank Daniel Talesnik for readily sharing his in-depth research about Tibor Weiner, his involvement in the Red Bauhaus Brigade, and their lasting loyalty to their former teacher, Hannes Meyer. During our interview, so many new connections have formed in my mind, leading to new insights for which I'm infinitely grateful. Not least because I'm currently working on a publication and an exhibition about those Bauhauslers who were involved in the design, construction and equipment of the ADGB Trade Union School in Bernau, the very school that was designed and built during Meyer's directorship, 1928-30, and in which numerous students were involved. And yes, Philipp Tolzina, Antonin Urban, Konrad Püschel and Tibor Weiner were among them. If you like to explore this topic further, there's more to listen to on Bauhaus Faces. Don't miss my episode on Lena Meyer-Bergner, featuring conversations with Viridiana Zavala and Sandra Neugärtner. Meyer-Bergner went to Moscow and headed a whole weaving factory there before emigrating to Mexico, where she produced remarkable work under entirely new conditions. Hers is a story just as compelling, shaped by movement, reinvention, and multiple departures. And keep an eye out for that upcoming bonus episode where we will turn to three other members of the so-called Red Bauhaus Brigade, Philipp Tolzina, Konrad Püschel, and René Mensch. Their stories, too, open up new perspectives on what it meant to carry the Bauhaus across borders and into uncertain futures. If you liked this episode or any other episode of Bauhaus Faces, as always, please don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or YouTube and to recommend it to friends, family and colleagues who might be interested too. And don't forget to subscribe to my podcast newsletter on bauhausfaces.com to stay up to date about new episodes of Bauhaus Faces. it will immediately pop up once you enter the website. You can also follow the podcast on Instagram via the handle @BauhausFacesPodcast. And now, there's nothing left to say but tune in next time for a new episode of Bauhaus Faces.